ionospheric signal or a moonbound signal. Let me drop.
Echo Link.
K2L.
N2RDB. NBEMS.
BWW. Echo Link. IRLP. Mobile Turbo. D-Star.
As you can see, I guess it was Bernie who asked the question. Boy, there's a lot of kinds. When it comes to just talking about weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT, K1JT, Joe Taylor, a Nobel laureate, invented this technique where the computer-generated signal is a sequence of four tones, and the right combination of the four tones allows you to transmit the whole alphabet and numbers 1, 0 through 9. That technique, properly implemented with Reed-Solomon demodulation techniques, fancy kind of mathematics, is able to listen to a signal 27 or 28 decibels below the noise. A human head sets up ears listening to that signal in the noise, says, nothing is there. I don't hear a single thing. And the WSJT converter program on your computer listening to the IF strip of your radio is printing out the message across the screen with a 95% copy and telling you what is the accuracy rate of it. Just to give you an example of some of the recent recent new kinds. Who else had some other suggestions for kinds of ham radio? Give me your call letters again. K2LAW.
BGB.
Hello. Okay, I heard WGB and a bunch of other people in town, but John, what did I miss?
Basic QRC.
Run that by again, John.
The QRP, the boys below the 5 watts.
Another good point. Very good point. So the weak signal, the real weak signal guys, there are guys that run less than 5 watts, there are guys that run less than 5 milliwatts. And particularly on UHF frequencies with these 35 dB gain antennas you can get with a parabolic dish, you can transmit some ridiculous number of miles with that. And when it comes to miles per watt, you come up with, you know, million miles per watt type stuff. Who else was giving us a suggestion?
K2YO.
Go ahead, Bernie.
About transmitter hunting, counter hunting, contesting, internet linking. You already got my STR favorite. Quick question, Dick. Are you on your traditional setup? Has anything changed in your setup in the last week?
N2RDB.
RDB recognized. Nothing has changed on my setup. What makes you ask that question, Bernie? Go ahead.
Maybe a little bit windy, but you've got some fluctuation on your signal that you don't normally have. I'm just looking at the repeater input. So maybe a loose connection if you don't have wind moving your antenna around. It's the same thing we see when people start going mobile.
Kilo Charlie 2 Romeo Sierra Foxtrot 60, you have a copy.
Romeo Sierra Foxtrot, beautiful copy, but RDB first. Mr. RDB, you started with your name and your comment, sir.
Yeah, name here is Tim. I'm a regular listener. NBEMS, Narrowband Emergency Messaging System. It's actually several low bandwidth digital modes that have recently become available to us. And, of course, we've used tactical voice, analog voice point-to-point communications in public service events for years in ARIES and to RDB.
Good suggestions, and thank you for that, Tom. KC2RSF in Tuckerton, New Jersey. Go right ahead, Tom. What would you like to add to this? KC2 Romeo Sierra Foxtrot. Go ahead, Tom. Okay, maybe you just want to know if we're hearing him. Bernie, I think we somewhat answered your question. I'm beginning to think that when the league official in the introductory package and page on the QSC magazine of about 2 years ago said 26 or 27 kinds, I think when you start looking at the logical combinations of modes, computers, modes of modulation, modes of demodulation, kinds of antennas, kinds of frequencies, with and without computers, with and without satellites and aurora and meteor scatter and moon bounce and so on, I'm slowly concluding that 26 kinds of ham radio is probably too low a number. It's now a function of how you put the various combinations, permutations and combinations together. I think I could come up with a bigger number. K2, Mike Uniform. Interesting question, Bernie. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, nobody mentioned satellite, too, by the way. Yeah, well, that's why I'm interested. I was interested. If you start thinking, there's got to be, it's even a lot more than that, depending on how it's categorized. So I wonder what that gentleman from the QST magazine had in mind. I tell you, it would be interesting to see a list, however it was devised, 27 or 54 or whatever it is. I'd be a lot more interested in checking off that list than, say, DXCC, you know. The possible mode and configuration. I'd love to see that on a list. And just wondering about that number 2627. So I guess we ought to ask the gentleman that wrote that in QST. But yeah, it would seem, depending on how you categorize it there, it could be a lot more than that. But okay, just a light question, not too technical, just enjoying reading the mail here. And back to you, K2RIW on the net, K2MU.
Very fine, Bernie. Awful glad you asked the question. And the other Bernie, K2MU, K2YO, my Yagi antenna is aimed to the southwest, favoring the repeater, and where you're located, you might be off to one of the side lobes, so very minor motion of my antenna waving back and forth in the wind could create quite a bit of QSB. That may be it. I'm looking at my transmitter. I'm putting out normal power. I'm not seeing the power wave. I'm looking at reverse power, in other words, my standing wave ratio. I'm not seeing that wave. So I think it's antenna aiming. And my rotator needs repair, so I can't reorient the antenna to see if that's the factor to straighten that out. I think I've gone down the list of the people who signed in the beginning, and I hope I haven't skipped anybody. If so, speak now. For instance, KB2JXM or anyone else who I may have skipped, please give me your call letters, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You sound identical here, by the way, Dick.
Thank you. Glad to hear that. Have I missed anyone?
N2XJN.
N2XJN, you're on the list, Wesley. And we'll be getting to your kind of subjects, the more deep subjects, after Paul. Go ahead, Wesley.
Thank you very much. That's what I wanted to say. I'm going to be waiting till, I believe, very exciting information about the space are going to come out on this repeater and to actually.
Yeah, the curiosity has been launched, and it's time we hear from Paul. The man who knows, who's been watching, the man who keeps track of NASA and makes sure that they're really doing it right. Paul, tell us what that launch was like. I bet you watched it live, if I know you. WS2N, a space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yes, I watched it live. 10:02 in the morning on Saturday. And, of course, the recorders were running, so I tried it. Take all the flights, the launches and the landings, and, you know, whatever breaking news that's on, and then edit them and compress them and then put them on disk. But yeah, I keep doing that. And it was a good launch. They were supposed to go up Friday. They had to change out a battery. That cost them a day. It went off on time. They did have an hour and 43-minute window that they could have used, but didn't. Took off on a, looked it up, it was a 34.8-degree inclination, and that set them up to head to Mars, you know, quite a few hours later, a couple hours later, sent to a rocket, launched, you know, ignited again, and then that put the spacecraft on the way to Mars. It's a big thing, the diameter of that cruise stage that you're looking at as it's going to Mars is 15 feet. So it's a big thing. It's give you an idea of the Apollo, the bottom of the Apollo, heat shield was about 13 feet. So this is even bigger, wider than the Apollo missions. I mean, it's probably about twice as wide as the MER, the Opportunity, and Spirit cruise stage. Let me drop it. Going to get there to Mars August 8th. Correction, August 6th, I think it was. August 6th or 8th. I believe it was the 6th, whatever. 8.5 months from now. And I believe it'll be an afternoon landing. We'll look forward to that. A lot of things have to go right. We discussed that on and that before about the sky crane that's going to be involved. No more airbags bouncing along the surface. This thing's way too big for that. It's twice as long as the previous Mars rovers. Instead of about 5 feet long, it's like 10 feet long. It's much wider too. It's 9 feet wide. Stands to the top of the mast and all are 7 feet. So it's a heavy thing. It's 2,000 pounds, a little over 2,000 pounds riding around, you know, that's going to be riding around. Well, 2,000 pounds Earth weight. And that's about five times heavier than the previous rovers. Let me drop it to WS2M. When it does get to Mars, it'll be able to drive like the length of two football fields, about 600 feet per day. It's got gigantic wheels on it. They showed it on CNN. The guy had a wheel, and a news reporter picked it up. It's about almost 30 inches in diameter, this thing, each wheel. Naturally, there's six wheels. And interesting thing about the wheels, look at them real close. Now, they didn't bring it up on the news, but they do have this on the JPL website. How is this related to ham radio? There's Morse code on the wheel itself. The letters JPL are, you know, there's big holes in the wheels. If you look at it shows you got a dot, a dash, and a dash, you know, the J, and the P, and the L. And the way it's written, it's if you had a can and you wrote across the can, J, and then below that, a P and an L, it's written in that fashion. So this way, when it rolls on the planet, it'll create marks. You'll be able to see this Morse code in the sand. Drop it. Or whatever they're on. On Mars, and the reason for it is it has a practical purpose. They can tell how far they're rolling. They program it, and just like the other rovers, they program it, and it'll ride a certain amount of distance. They know how many turns the motors are going. They can tell if there's a strain on the motors with how much amperage is coming back. All the data comes back. But sometimes the wheels might slip or whatever, and they want to double check or verify what they're looking at. They could look at one of their cameras. There's 17 cameras on board this Curiosity. Mars Science Laboratory is well equipped, so if any cameras fail, it'll still be able to navigate. It'll be able to look at the track that it makes, and it'll be able to see the code and the ground. And they can tell exactly if they went 1 foot or 2 feet or whatever it might be, if they're in a critical situation. I thought I'd bring that up. Also, communication. Let me drop it. Very similar to the other landers. It does have three antennas on board, a low gain and a high gain, for communicating directly with Earth if they need to do that, which they probably will, especially in the very beginning. They need to, what they're going to do is they got to get their orientation before they use that. In the very beginning, they're going to use UHF antenna probably quite a bit. That'll be communicating with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter in orbit around Mars. So they'll have a link with that. They'll use that as a repeater. If that's not working for any reason, they could also use the Odyssey, that's also in orbit around Mars, and even the Mars Express by the European Space Agency, which is still in orbit around Mars. But they have three repeaters that they could use. The big one, of course, is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's a big, huge spacecraft. That's the last one that we sent up there, which has a lot of capabilities. Different bands that they use with that thing to test with. Common transmission modes are usually in the X band. Drop it. I think I want to time this thing out. On the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, they have something called the KA. They use the KA band. I know you know that. That's 3 or 4 times higher in frequency, and they use that to test. You could transmit a lot more data on a higher frequency, of course. So, but they could also use this for communications with the Mars Science Laboratory. If some of the other communications fail, they could use this method. So, a lot of capabilities, a lot of backups. It's got on board. It's got a laser beam, shoot at rocks, to vaporize the rock, tell from a distance what that rock is made of. Got an analyzer on board. Also, you can pick up dirt, you can grind into a rock, for instance, and suck up the dust from it and put it into this test bed inside the Curiosity and run tests with it, tell if there's any organics involved. See, the original two Mars rovers were looking for proof of water. This is actually looking for organics. Was the Mars surface, conducive for life at one time, or still may be? They'll be looking for carbon deposits or whatever. So this thing is a real laboratory going up there. Much more complex. What I like about it is, let me drop it. US2N is that it does have the plutonium-238 power supply on it. It's got the RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, where the two previous rovers, and including the one before that, the one that was about as big as a microwave oven, Pathfinder Sojourner mission, that the Sojourner was solar-powered, so was Opportunity, so was Spirit. I mean, they did have a little bit of plutonium on board to keep the, 1 watt of heat, keeping the electronic box warm. But this thing's got a regular generator for generating power, tremendous amount of power. you're going to have 24 hours of electricity on this thing. You don't have to worry about daytime or nighttime. Budgeting the time as much as you did with the previous landers. So that's a real good thing. So I got plenty of other information if you have any questions, or anybody else. Dick, back to you. This is WS2N.
Question.
Well done, Paul. I'll get to John in a minute. Anyone who is at all interested in space and Mars and what NASA is doing, I strongly recommend you go to Google and just hit the word Mars Science Laboratory as a search word, and look for the NASA site, or you can go directly to it if you want. It's a little bit more difficult. NASA.gov/mission_pages/MSL, which stands for Mars Science Laboratory, MSL/index.html. But you'll find that all automatically if you just Google the words Mars Science Laboratory. And when you go to that site, it gives you lots of information. First thing you'll find out is that since launch has been 1 day, 11 hours, 20 minutes, and 59 seconds. I'm reading it off their page right now. It's continuously being updated. You'll see some beautiful pictures of this automobile-sized thing that's many thousands of pounds that's going to land on Mars next August after going 315 million miles. Let me drop. And when you find the right section of the NASA site, you will see a computer-animated movie of what the landing sequence will look like. And you look at that movie and it's going to scare you. It's going to scare you because of how elaborate it is. This thing is going to be lowered to the surface of Mars on a rocket-propelled sky crane. And I'm not kidding. They had no choice. Everyone who's a critic of NASA will say, gee, you guys developed this great airbag bouncing technique for landing. Why the hell didn't you use it again? And the answer is this thing is so many thousands of pounds heavier. No way in hell could they develop airbags that could tolerate that and bounce on it. This is a much bigger, real, serious science laboratory looking for organics, not just looking for water. It's doing, you know, real laboratory research on all the materials it finds. Are there any organics there? Is there any evidence of past life? That's what they're really looking for. So a huge piece of hardware had to be sent there, nuclear-powered, and so it's going to do a very serious research. It's a quite an expensive machine, and that landing sequence, darn many things have to go right, and there's only one of these machines being sent. We didn't have the money to build two of them like we did with Spirit and Opportunity. Curiosity, this machine, there's only one. Let me drop. So when you see the animation of that landing sequence, all of the things that have to go just right, of dumping the heat shield and putting out the drogue chuting, putting out the real parachute, and deploying the sky crane, and lowering the vehicle on a tether on the sky crane with its four rockets, decelerating the thing just right and landing it softly on Mars, cutting that cable, and then the sky crane flying off to get out of the way. That sequence is so complicated. Guaranteed there's going to be a lot of nail-biting in August. Everything has got to go just right. And if you think of the past experience of the Spirit and Opportunity, they discovered a glitch in the computer program, and a few hours before entering the Martian atmosphere, they shipped up a brand new computer code to correct the glitch and hope that the computer code would get there correctly in the right amount of time to correct an error where they thought a particular switch wouldn't close at the right time. And that all came out, it was a squeaker, but it came out correctly with Spirit and Opportunity. Is there going to be another one of those with Curiosity? It's something to worry about. A lot of hardware, a lot of things that got to go just right. Hey, John, I hear tell that you're going to be giving us eventually some brand new pictures on the QIZ.com website for KC2WGB. And so there's three beautiful pictures there of your laboratory. I hear tell of more are on the way. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, everybody on the web, on the net. That's in the works right now. And some of them are going to be pictures of experiments that I've run, so a little bit will be interesting. But I have two questions for Paul. And the first one is, Paul, was that a direct ascent, or did they have to go into a parking orbit and then ascend from there? The second question is, does that rover have a light bar, like on an articulated arm, for dark areas? I didn't notice that on the photographs that I saw of that item. Maybe you could say a few words about that.
You got it, Paul. Wait for the beeps.
John, the my thought was just going to go, you know, one time around, and then that was it. So, I mean, inside of, I think it was an hour and a little over an hour, I say that thing was on its way to Mars. It didn't even go around
like, you know, a parking orbit. It was like a 200 by 100 mile orbit, you know, slightly elliptical, and then the Centaur rocket flies again, and that's it. On the dark side of the Earth, it took off to Mars. You know, if you have a globe, you put it on that, you know, 23 and a half degree angle, put the light in front of it, you tilt it away from the light, make it look like it is now, you know, almost winter time. You can see at 10 o'clock in the morning, the thing took off on one side of the Earth, and then, you know, across the equator, went down to 34 degrees. And by the time it got to the backside, it's equal to around where the equator is, and that's where it launched the Centaur rocket again. And I think twice puts it into first orbit, and then they light it again to put it on the way to Mars. So that's going. And one more time, I'm dropping. Fly one more time after the crew stage is disconnected. By the way, they have a picture of the crew stage in flight, separated from the Centaur upper rocket. Centaur fires one more time, and that's to put itself completely away from the same trajectory as Curiosity, because they don't want that thing to wind up going back to Mars or anywhere near Mars or anywhere near Curiosity. That thing goes into a solar orbit, you might call it. But by doing one more burn, there's no way in the world that's going to, you know, get anywhere near the planet. And that's pretty much it. LIGO, I don't see that. I know they had that. That was a big thing on the other rovers. So I don't know if they need that. They probably have everything calibrated from the last ones. They know exactly how to set it this time, but they did need that last time to get the proper colors and all. 17 cameras. Let me drop it. Some of them are black and white. Some of them are infrared. And, of course, they've got the one that on the mast, which is going to be able to look around like the ones on the old rovers. And this one has the arm, also like the other rover, comes out, drill into the rocks and all. It's got a detector below the unit, which has it's a neutron detector, and any kind of moisture that might be under the ground, you know, is possible. There might be you know, they believe that there's, you know, once in a while there is frozen ice, they know that, but once in a while it might defrost a little bit. They'll be able to detect that, even if it's ice, with this neutron detector. It detects hydrogen, is what it is. So all kinds of detectors on board. I think it's 10 different experimental gadgets on board this thing. So it's quite involved. Back to you, Dick, WS2.
I'm not sure if it was a news report that I was reading or heard it over the air. I think in 2 days is the very first trajectory burn correction maneuver. In other words, they're going to fire a rocket in 2 days, if need be, to make the accuracy of aiming it toward Mars better. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that might have happened a couple of times, about three or four times during the flight, if need be. If need be. So if you heard that, that means they're going to do it. But as far as I know, right now they don't need to do that. But if you heard it, yeah, they must have made a decision on that. All these deep space flights have mid-course corrections to them. One or two or three, you know, and they like to keep that to a minimum. There's only a certain amount of fuel. They have on board the cruise stage. You know, this thing separates from everything else when it gets to Mars, but on a cruise stage, I mean, this thing's a regular spaceship in itself. It does have 8 thrusters on board, hydrazine thrusters, and it could adjust itself in flight. It is spinning roughly two times per minute. That was set up by the Centaur rocket. It fired its rocket and started itself spinning before it separated from Curiosity. So we talk about the plutonium on board Curiosity, but the crew stage, it does not run by that. It actually has a gigantic solar panel on the back and batteries dropping. It's a complex spacecraft in itself. On takeoff, it's actually communicating with the launch vehicle, the Atlas, in the air, sent to a rocket. And then when it separates from that, the rest of the flight, it's actually communicating, making sure all the systems are going well on board Curiosity, transmitting information from that data back to Earth through its antenna. It has a low and high gain antenna on board. It does have I don't know the fluids that they use, but there's a piping system on board where you could take the you could pump heat around there. You've got to get rid of heat from the electronics, and you might want to get rid of it. And they have radiators which dissipated into space, or some of the electronics might want to be warm, and they have these fluids connections going near that, and it's got all kinds of thermostats on board, and also it's a spaceship in itself, and when that separates, that will not go near the planet. That doesn't crash onto the planet, and then after that, that's when the 8 minutes of terror start. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, earlier you mentioned that the communication link is using the Ka band, and each of the frequency regions, like L-band, S-band, C-band, X-band, and so on, they all have what used to be classified frequencies during World War II. These letter designations represented certain frequencies that we didn't want an adversary to know about, and those letters that got carried over into the non-military world, now they're well-established. So Ka-band is between 26.5 and 40 gigahertz, according to Wikipedia. So that's, as you go higher and higher in frequency in free space, the same dish antenna can be smaller and still give you higher gain. And that's what you really want to do, is you want to take that valuable amount of transmit power, which is probably in the 10 watt category. Many of these transmitters on spacecraft run around 10 watts of the downlink. At 10 watts, you want to squirt it like a flashlight beam directly back to Earth, where it gets picked up with the deep space network, like the 240-foot Goldstone dish, and there's a similar one in Spain and a similar one in Australia. Every 120 degrees around the Earth, let me drop.
And let me correct something on the Ka dish.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that's on board the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. They use that as a test to communicate with Earth. The main one that they use is the X-band, the 8 to 12 gigahertz frequency. But they do have the Ka. It's good for, what do they call it? Give the name that they use for this whole system. But it's like a backup, basically, for in case of other things go wrong. You know, they'll have this Ka thing, but I don't think they're going to use that. There's something. It's called the Electra, ELECTRA, and I think that's involved with this band. And it could provide precise Doppler capacity, determining the location of the lander. You know, if they're having trouble, so they're going to use it for that. And then when the spacecraft is in the nadir, right above it, then it would be able to communicate with it if it was having problems. Like, you know, maybe they want to upload or download a program or something if something's wrong. They have that capability. A lot of backups is what I was trying to say, but it's really the X-band.
Now, Ka band, I think you're saying is used on Mars orbiter, and even as a backup, does the Mars Science Laboratory, the Curiosity, it does or doesn't have Ka band capability? Paul, go ahead.
From what I read, that this Ka is the used for the Electra. I'd like to clarify that, though. That I'm not really sure about. I wouldn't say that's written in granite. But, whatever this Electra thing is, this what they can do, this Doppler capability to determine the location, that is on Mars Science Laboratory. They did say as long as, you know, future landers, including this one or whatever they're sending there, has that. I believe Phoenix had it as well, in case they needed it, but they didn't. Thank you.
Now, one of the first questions people ask is, how in the world do you get very accurate tracking information about where is the trajectory of a spacecraft like this one? To aim it for Mars, roughly 315 million miles away, accuracy-wise, it's way beyond a hole in one. However, as long as you've got good tracking capability, where you know where it is, how fast it's moving, and what direction it's moving, you can decide that, hey, you're going to miss the golf course hole, by being 3 feet to the right, and let's steer it a little bit to the left type stuff. And the sooner you know that information, the sooner you make the mid-course correction, so to speak, the less fuel you've got to burn later on in order to hit the hole-in-one, to really hit the very small reentry window, which allows you to hit the Mars atmosphere at just the right angle where you don't go in too fast or too slow. Too slow and you skip out too fast and you generate too much heat. So there's a rather narrow window they're looking for in this landing sequence. One more of the things that's required. Let me drop. Now, the way the Deep Space Network operates, and this was developed in the mid-60s, and when I visited NASA headquarters in Houston, Texas, right after Apollo 13, this was way back in 1971, they gave me this great big green manual explaining the Deep Space Network, which I still have a copy of. I better look at my serial number. It may be an interesting piece of record, history, so to speak. But the way the Deep Space Network works is that you would think ordinarily the transmitter on board the spacecraft would have to be a very accurate crystal. And in the early days, that was a problem, because to make a very accurate crystal, like a cesium beam or a rubidium oscillator, and to qualify it for space application, where it's going to experience tremendous vibration on launch, all kinds of temperature extremes and radiation extremes and everything else during the flight, to make a crystal oscillator be accurate enough for that environment is essentially out of the question. Therefore, the frequency accuracy of the spacecraft transmitter is located on the ground. The way the Deep Space Network works is that with a very accurate cesium beam oscillator, you transmit a signal to the satellite. The satellite's got a phase lock loop system that sweeps in a sawtooth manner and finds that signal. It locks onto that signal. It then takes the input signal and divides it by the ratio of 221 over 240. They always use that number in S-band. I am guessing they still use that exact same quasi-irrational number. It's really a rational number. In X-band. They used to use it in S-band. So by dividing by 240 over 221, you then use that divide circuit as the retransmitter of the downlink. Just to give you an exact example, when I listened to Apollo 15 and 16, I knew that the uplink was 21...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I knew that the downlink was going to be 2287.5 megahertz. 2287.5. That's a 2 gig signal, almost a 2.3 gig signal. 2287.5 was the downlink. You do the division of 240 over 221, and you realize the uplink is 2106.4. Very valuable information to me. First of all, the 2287.5, I listened to that on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. While that mission was in lunar orbit, I listened to those signals. I think I got something like a 3 or 5 hours worth of signals on Apollo 15 and something like 16 hours on Apollo 16 of recordings of me listening to the downlink during the time that they were not, their 10-watt transmitter, 250,000 miles away, with my little 12-foot dish over there in Farmingdale, recording the astronaut audio, and I knew exactly what frequency the uplink was. I knew that the uplink was going to be a 10-kilowatt transmitter from the 240-foot dish at Goldstone, California. And I did a calculation. I said, how strong is that signal going to be when it bounces off the moon? They're aiming the signal directly at the satellite. The satellite is going sometimes in front of the moon. Therefore, I know that the dish in Goldstone is going to, at times, be aimed right at the center of the moon, and 99.9% of the signal is much wider than the satellite. It's going to miss the satellite, hit the moon, and bounce off the moon. I went in tune with the phase lock loop system of that spectrum analyzer, which was my front end, borrowed from AIO at the time, and I listened to the uplink. I listened to the signals being sent from Goldstone, bouncing off the moon, coming back to me with FM modulation. I heard astronaut, let's call it astronaut, I heard mission headquarters uplink audio by bouncing off the moon, as well as listening to the downlink, depending on which one of the frequencies I listened to. I could hear the results. And in the case of, let me drop. In the case of Apollo 16, that was real exciting when Mattingly, Young, and Duke created their joke where they were telling the ground control, just as they went behind the moon the very first time and they're going to be out of range, so to speak, and they said, okay, NASA, at mission elapsed time, so-and-so, I'm going to do a burn for X number of minutes. Houston, do I do that burn toward the moon or away from the moon? That was a joke, but that was gallows humor. Guarantee the guys on the ground, if they didn't know that that joke was coming, were saying, is he serious? Because if you make a mistake on that lunar injection burn, game is over real fast. And so as they go around the moon on the left-hand side in clockwise manner, top view, they go behind the moon, they issue that mission, that crazy message in the downlink. Goldstone, California hears that mission. It gets relayed to Houston, Texas, building number 30, and those guys start chewing their nails for the next 45 minutes until the astronauts come out the other side of the moon and say that all's well. And because they're going behind the moon in a clockwise manner, the shadow of the moon was sweeping across the United States from California toward New York. I'm in New York, and I'm hearing the downlink signal for another 10 or 15 seconds as that shadow sweeps across the United States. I heard the astronauts, after they'd issued that joke, and they were out of communication range with Goldstone, I heard them laughing. You know, they didn't say it, but I know that the general message between each other was, I wonder what they're going to say on that one. So, now, let me tell you one more thing about this unified S-band signal system. Let me drop. Because the receiver on board the spacecraft phase locks to the uplink signal sent with a very accurate oscillator at, let's say, Goldstone or one of the other two dishes, and then it divides that signal by an exact ratio, 240 over 221, and transmits the signal back down. It's actually a multiplication. You know the exact frequency going up, you know the exact frequency coming back down. They first send a pseudo-random code that allows them to do coarse range lockup, where they can figure out the range on the ground very accurately with that pseudo-random code, because they know the exact code they're transmitting, and the code that comes back down, you slide the downlink code versus the one you sent up in the time domain until they match each other, and you say, aha, I now know to the nearest, let me pick a number, nearest mile, or nearest fraction of a mile, what is the range. Then the next thing they do is go to the next step and count cycles of S-band signal. S-band signal, 2287.5 megacycles, roughly 4.5 inch long, 4.5 inch wavelength. Each individual cycle of what went up and what came back down is 4.5 inches long. You can resolve the range of the satellite in space, millions of miles away from you, to the nearest fraction of a foot of exact range and range rate. Do you see the accuracy you can get out of that system? Fantastic. It's a very well-designed system. And so once you know the range rate and you figure out that range rate, and there are times when as the Earth rotates, two different dishes, like the one in Spain and the one in California, or the one in California and the one in Australia, can see the spacecraft simultaneously from those two different angles, two different places on the Earth as the Earth rotates. And you figure out very carefully the geometry of those ranges and range rates, and now you know the range and cross-range accuracy of where that ship is going. You don't know...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
You now know range rate, and azimuth very accurately. You don't know elevation quite as accurately. And there's other ways they can get that. So by doing some fancy mathematics on the ground tracking equipment of the satellite signal, you now know exactly where it is, how fast it's moving, and what direction it's moving, and you know very soon whether or not it's going to hit the proper window at Mars or whether it's going to miss it, and whether or not you've got to do a burn in some particular direction for some number of seconds to do a mid-course correction. I wonder if you've ever heard any of that jazz before, Paul. Some of that was explained to me during my visit when I had a chance to see literally some of the astronauts way back in 1971. WS2N for any further comments, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I know they talk about here the Doppler effect, so, you know, we know about that, ranging with that, and radars and this and that, but, which is kind of similar, but a bit different. But, they have to know exactly where this thing is because they want to point these high-gain antennas directly toward Earth, and you get a lot of it. Whole pictures, when, you know, of that. He's thinking maybe a month, maybe two before he gets all his data. You know, there's going to be other important data that has to go through. There's only so much I can go through. I think it's, I forget the bit rate for the high gain. But whatever it is, it's not, you know, for 8,000 pictures, you drop it.
Yeah, run that by again, Paul, and make sure you wait for the four beeps that I didn't do. Are you saying the spacecraft called Mars Science Laboratory, that while it's going through that complicated sequence of encountering the Mars atmosphere and landing, are you saying that it's going to take its own 8,000 pictures during the landing sequence and eventually send those back? Over to you, Paul. Wait for the beeps.
I watched three different conferences that they had, and this was one of them. At the time, there was 150 people before me that watched this thing. I guess it's on live, and then you could view it on a computer. Now I think it's up to a couple of thousand, but... you go to the NASA site and they have all these different conferences that you could watch. And this one guy who was in charge of this doing 8,000 pictures. And the idea is to put them all together so he could have a movie film of this whole thing. But, you know, that's going to be a long time. So much other data, you know, is much more important than his. Although they will need it for future use, you know, for future landings and whatever they might need it for, you know, that's his job. But unfortunately, you know, they think, oh, you're going to get it right back. He says, no, it might take him a month or two before he gets all his data and he can put it all together. So I forgot the data rate. They mentioned the data rate during that news conference. But whatever it is, it's he's got a long way. Let me drop it. I want to mention one thing about the power supply.
And I have a question, Dick.
Before I forget, I know it's going to come up sooner or later between now and probably when they go into the Mars atmosphere 8 months from now. Is the power supply on board? The plutonium puts out 110 watts in the beginning. 80 years from now, is it 80? No, they go down to 80%, I forget how many years, whatever. It's a long time. I wrote it down somewhere. 87.7 year, that's the half-life of this plutonium. And by that time, they're down to, what percent?
It's like still like 60 or 80%. So it's some huge number. So this stuff never runs out. The thermo couplings tend to burn out first. But to make a long story short, 110 watts, so roughly 2.2 kilowatt hours per day to run this whole thing. Operate the wheels, the laser beam, everything.
So therefore it's capable of running 24 hours a day, so to speak. A Mars day, I think, is like 25 hours long. So it'll run at night and daytime if they want to. And so we don't know if it's got a set of headlights yet. Before I turn it back to John for his question, we're fairly sure it doesn't have any headlights so it can see where it's going at nighttime, or is it a real good navigator that doesn't even need the light? Give us a couple words on that if you happen to know, Paul. Go ahead.
They won't be driving it at night, but they will, you know, they take pictures all the time as they're going. In fact, it's autonomous. If something comes up that they don't like a, you know, a sudden drop off or something, they have these infrared cameras, stereo cameras, which they'll know how far away they are, and it'll tell the computer to shut this thing down if there's a problem. The thing is, a lot of lost time at night. It could be doing experiments at night where the other two, you know, they were sitting there trying to recharge their batteries all the time. You don't have to worry about that. So you drive to where you're going, and then if you want to conduct experiments in the middle of night, you can. You know, with the weather station and the radios and, and operating all these different motors for the wheels. And these wheels are big. I'm telling you, they're about 30 inches in diameter. I think a little bit less than that, but they're huge. You could take, the one guy said, you could take the original Mars Sojourner and put it inside one of the wheels. I'm just amazed that this thing will run, like they're talking about a 2.2 kilowatt hours. Every day, but still, that doesn't sound like that much to me. But I guess they're happy with the thing.
For a whole bunch of reasons, it moves very slow, Paul, by you and my automobile driving experience. In fact, what is the approximate driving speed? Is it around 2 miles an hour or something like that, Paul?
Yeah, it's actually the same as the other rovers. I think it's no more than that. Distance is 600 feet per day. That's it. And this thing is designed for it's actually one Mars year, which is roughly about two of our years, so two Earth years. Let's see how long it goes. Well, let's make sure it gets there first, but then let's see how long it goes. The other one was designed for 30 days or something, and one is Spirit quit, Opportunity is still running, and that was 1974 January when both of those landed. So I think the 3rd and the 14th respectively. Spirit landed first and then Opportunity was we'll see. I mean, this thing has this gigantic half-life of 80-some-odd years. You know, it's going to be riding around, I don't know, I'm hoping it goes for 5, 6, 7 years like the previous rovers. But I don't know. 2 miles an hour, I thought 3 miles an hour was the MER, but I might be wrong. Whatever, it's still about 600 feet.
And you said 1974 was the launch of Spirit and Opportunity, and I think you meant 2004. I make mistakes like that all the time. Every time I listen to any of the recordings, I say, why in the world did I say that? Hey, John, KC2WGB, what would you like to know more about this jazz? K2LAW.
Yes, I thought of a question, Dick. About the landing of this structure. I've seen some photographs of the topography of Mars, and it is rugged. Now, do they have
an expansive Mar area that they're going to target, or are they going to revisit the same area they went before? How do they choose the landing site, and like how far away is it from that rugged terrain? I'm sure you've seen those pictures. Back to you, Dick.
They're going to Gale Crater, Dick.
Yeah, one of the websites explained the fact that this Gale Crater, it's got a nice depression where it's got all kinds of geological stuff they want to look at, and it itself has got some fairly smooth terrain, but around it, it's got some pretty rugged terrain. They believe they have enough landing choice at that spot. Why don't you give us some more words on this one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it's a 50-kilometer diameter instead of, what, 300, I think it was for the other one. So, yeah, they've narrowed that down. They've got all, well, you'll see on the animation, as it comes through the atmosphere, I mean, there's these weights that are going to be falling off to try to stabilize it. They've got thrusters on board. It's going to be fine-tuning its way all the way down into the, you know, right down to the end. So they're highly confident that they're going to land with a soft like that in a very small footprint.
What a machine. Boy, there's a lot of stuff on there. How in the world do you do a real proof of concept test of that sky crane that's going to do all that valuable work of slowly lowering the spacecraft on this tether away from the sky crane, providing just the right thrust? The Martian gravity is very different than Earth gravity. The Martian atmosphere is very different than Earth atmosphere. How in the world do you test a thing like that, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I should have wrote down the website. I don't know if you... I guess you didn't see the test. This, I mean, you know, they have this thing in a laboratory and they drop it, looks like, from the ceiling. And I assume this is a mock-up that they were using. But, you know, it's got the wheels and everything on it. And when they released it, I mean, it looks like it just... this thing is just dropped like a rock. And with these cables coming out of it. And you know, in the laboratory, you know, they got the microphone on, you can hear this thing, and it sounds like this is going to be bad news when you see the test. You know, I mean, standing on Mars, if you were to see this thing come through from outer space, first of all, it looks more like a, when it comes through, it really looks like a gigantic flying saucer. You know, it's pretty wide. It's not a shape like you would normally think, you know. It's not like a capsule, like an Apollo. And this thing's really like a narrow shape to it. And then to come through and then have this thing come out and drop like a, really drop like a rocket, around 200 feet off the ground. And having these eight rockets firing before this all happens. And then as it comes to a grinding halt, it shifts to four rockets instead of eight rockets. And to have this thing land, and then as it hits the ground, the rockets are still firing. 2 seconds later, after it's on the ground, it notifies the sky crane to cut the cables, and off it goes. I mean, a lot has to happen here.
That's an understatement, Paul. A lot's got to happen. When I watched those animations of the landing sequence, I get a little worried. I'm positive there's going to be a lot of nail biting during that reentry, and all of our news programs will be concentrated on Pasadena, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and you'll see those scientists watching all the displays and periodically cheering if it goes well. Otherwise, there'll be an awful lot of silence in that room.
That's the best site to go to, by the way, Dick.
Yeah, tell me about that. If I just simply go to Google and use as a search word Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Mars Science Laboratory, will I get the right combination? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you you wind up with a million sites if you just put in, you know, MSL or Curiosity. And I, you know, which I did. I went to a million different sites. I found the best one with a lot of the